and neither bring anger for bad men to glow, nor jealous like envy of wicked ones, no. Because of their hurt will the bad do without. The lamp of ungodly men shall be put out. Proverbs 24, verses 19 and 20. From the version of 2004 by yours truly, little children, that's our daily scripture for today. And continuing our study again in Trojan War, chapter 9, we're studying currently, the chapter we began yesterday, and we're on paragraph 2 today. Doesn't seem like too long of a chapter. It's a very interesting paragraph. It talks about the genealogy or genealogical calculations that unfortunately are often, seemingly anyway, often ignored by the conventional chronology. Or either that, or they just don't have any knowledge about the average, you know, ages of parents, you know, at the time of their at the time of the births of their firstborn, you know, that kind of thing. Or they're willing to make that a secondary consideration, perhaps, right? So we should explain the reasoning behind our chronology. I mean, we've considered so many different things. And even though we've been talking about radiocarbon, we've been talking about that quite a lot. Our chronology had nothing to do with carbon. B4, also called BG, TWT, and QWP, incorporated all known factors, including astronomic alignment and science of human birthing cycles, often missed by chronographers. Yeah, it's like they just forget about it. They don't even remember to do these calculations. For example, the average age of a father for the birth of a firstborn son, a generation, that's called a generation. And of course, there are generations for average generations that include all the children, sons and daughters, average generation as well as average for the firstborn son. They're different, right? The firstborn son average is near 27 to 28. The average for all children might be 35 years old at the birth, that is the father's age at the age, at the birth of their, on average at the birth of a child. A father's age might be 35 on average at the birth of a child, or 33 or something, whatever the average is. But we're concerned with the firstborn sons because in the case of royal families, it's the firstborn son who very often is the one who inherits the throne. So for firstborn sons, 27 or 28 years is typically how old a father is at the birth of his firstborn son. And if it's something radically different from that, then if there's an average that is over, anyone can be, say, let's say a father could be much older or not terribly much younger than that, but much older than that at the birth of his firstborn son. But the average over a long sequence or a large number of generations is 27 and 28. For the case of Shoshank the First to Passenhorn, 9 generations from the death of Shoshank in 959 BCE. In our chronology, he dies 959. That's the year 1 of Osorkon the First, his son. From the death of Shoshank in 959 to the estimated death of Passenhor, assuming that his 75th birthday was 55 years after an installation of an Apis bull in year 37 of Shoshank the Fifth, his age being 20 at its installation and 75 at his death, 20 being the minimum age for a priest. Right? So, let's say he was 50 years old at the installation and he only lived another 25 years, then we'd only be adding 25 instead of 55 here, which is a difference of 30 years divided by... That would make a significant difference, right? Because that would be a 30-year difference in the total, and it would make a difference divided by 9. 30 years is roughly 3 years different, so it would reduce the average to 24 years per generation. So that would be a big difference. Something like that would make a huge difference. But, you know, but the thing is here, we've gone from death to death here, too, in this calculation. We don't know the birth date of Shoshenko. We don't know the birth date of the priest. So we're assuming he died 55 years after the installation here. So we have the calculation. 959, well, maybe we should do it. I think we should do it. 959 minus 805. And the 805 would have had the 35 subtracted from it. But since we're doing it as a series of addition subtraction, the 805 would have had 37 subtracted from it to get the correct date for the installation, but it becomes added when we do it this way. So we're subtracting 805 and then adding back the 37 instead of taking it away from the 805 to begin with. So it's done correctly here, but also the amount of time after that he lived until he died was another 55. And so also that number would have been subtracted from the 805, but it becomes added to it because we've transferred the negative sign all the way through. And we could have subtracted 37 and 55 from 805 first. But we did it this way, which is the same exact way of doing it. 246. Okay, 246. But we need to put brackets here. Let's put brackets. Right, there we go. Divided by 9, 27.3 years per generation, just as indicated there. And we could do it birth to birth here, of course, with the birth of Shoshenko the First in 1049. Now, he began to rule in 993. Why we said 1049 for his birth, we could have made that significantly lower, that date, 1049. That would have made this average closer to 27. 9 generations, 2 years to get it down to 27. 2 years times 9 is 18, would have been 1031 for the birth of Shoshenko, if that were true, and if Passenhor were born in 788. But we could also have had Passenhor. When was the installation? It was 805 minus 37, right? It was 788. That's what that is. 788. Or is it? Let me think. 788. That doesn't seem right. Well, that's his birth. Yeah, 768. That's correct. Is the time of the installation. 768 plus 37. Right. Right, right, okay. So he's born in 788 if he's 20 years old at the installation. But he could have been born before that, and that would, again, if we had him be 18 years older, that would have also reduced the average to 27 here, birth to birth. So we're in completely good range here. with no problems caused by it. The Exodus date now, determined from the Bible, starting at the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BCE, was 1493 BCE. So, yeah, we're looking at the facts. We're not looking at... It has nothing to do with politics. It's got to do with facts. We're looking at the evidence and the facts. It's not political. And science is not, strictly speaking, the truth, but we're looking for the truth using science. We have to do that. I mean, we always do that. That's how we make progress. Science is just a way of organizing information using equations and using a method, a scientific method and so on, to keep track of what's happening, studying variables and things like that. But that's all science is. It's not against the truth. It's nothing to do with politics. And we've got the destruction of Jerusalem based on very much, very solid, we believe, solid evidence. Very solid, sound evidence. Strong evidence. Without that, we wouldn't be able to go backwards in time and do the other calculations. But then we confirmed the other calculations also, and we confirmed it's consistent with Jewish tradition, and we did all sorts of things to confirm the logic, and the astronomy agrees with it. Everything is in harmony with our dates here. So, I mean, they're not our dates only, they're the truth is the idea here. We're talking about the truth. We're not interested in one faction versus another. But we have to say that it's ours just to distinguish ourselves from the other erroneous chronologies. So 587, from that we determined 1493 as the Exodus, first of all by going back to King Solomon using the number of years given for the Jewish kings in the Bible. 430 years total back to King Solomon in 1017. I should show that because it's very useful to see it. I've done it, I guess, so many times that to me it's old hat. But 1017, put this down here. There we go. 1017 is not what we want. Well, we could subtract 430, do it that way. 587, or 587, let's just do it the other way, 587 plus 430, which is the number of years total for all the kings of Judah, all the way back to King Solomon, that is, and he came after his father David, but there we are, 1017 for year one Solomon. But then in his year four, which is 3 years later than that, so subtract 3, that's 1014. In Solomon's year 4, 1014 BCE, the temple was founded, and it was said to have been done in the 480th year after Israel came out of Egypt, according to the Bible. 1 Kings chapter, what is it, 6 or 7, which is it? 1 Kings 6 or 1 Kings 7? Wherever it is. It's 480 years, or the 480th year. So we had 479 years, and we get 1493. That's how we got there. So it's well established about the chronology, not just our chronology, but we're going to call it our chronology. It's not a political issue. It's our chronology because it's not the same as other people's chronologies. We have to give it a name. We have to give it an identifying label, right? And call it ours as opposed to some other chronology. And this date, 1493, agreed with the Sothic Rising, read in year 9, which was a Paphi 9 of year 9 of the king of Egypt, Amenhotep I. But we took it as referring back to year one of his reign. When we did that, it agreed, of course, with everything, because using that year one, with the year nine being just the record of his year one Sothic rising, we ended up with that year one as 1526, which was the year when Sothis rose, in other words, in his year one. But then it was, we don't have all the records, so we just have this year nine record. But it was, we're interpreting it as just being the anniversary of the Sothic rising, because they viewed the Sothic rising as so important. And if this Sothic rising happened in his year one, they would commemorate that. That was the assumption we made. No one else made the same assumption. But I mean, you know, it's a difference of 9 years is what it would result in if we didn't make that assumption. Or we could have had the rising of Sothis occur at a different time if we'd assumed different values for the visibility also. So we could have still ended up with the same result if we were looking for that result of 1550 for Amos, which is 1552 here, because we take the number of years Amos ruled, which is 25, add that to the year one of his successor, Amenhotep, and we get 25 years plus 1526 is 1551 or 1552, depending on extra months that could be there. But we found the most logical, best year one. It made the most sense according to all the everything considered, was 1552 or very late in that year, or 1551 for Amos, year one. And in 1493 for year one of it's not important about the pharaoh to do with some of these lunar alignments. They have to do with the very first Sabbath recorded in the Bible, in Exodus chapter 16, for example. That's a lunar alignment with a lunar month. So that lines up in 1493. We've got specific lunar alignments in 1493 in addition with the pharaohs of Egypt. But, I mean, not necessarily in that year, but according to the year 1493, having been the death of Thutmose the First. And the death of Thutmose the First was determined by Egyptologists independently of our chronology as being 1493. It was really fortuitous when I found that. I was incredulous, because I couldn't believe that no one else had found it, or everyone else had missed it. That no one else had been looking for the death of a pharaoh at the time of the Exodus, which the Bible says happened, that the pharaoh drowned along with all the others. So there should have been a death of a pharaoh. We found evidence that there was not only a pharaoh that drowned, but there was the death of his firstborn occurred also. You know, we have evidence in secular history of that as well. His firstborn did die, and his daughter later performed some kind of additional ceremony regarding a coffin much later, after he'd passed long before. So there was a lot of, and she wrote about vagabonds in the Northland and things that sounded like she was talking about the Exodus. So all of these, but we had lunar alignments too. I mean, we have lots of evidence, including astronomical evidence, like the rising of Sothis, the lunar alignments. The 1493 date is remarkable because we arrived at it using simple dead reckoning, but then we proved it using all kinds of other evidence. I mean, that's the only way to do it. You can't look for a number for the year of something and then look for lunar alignments. If you just choose a random number for the year number. You can't look for lunar alignments for every possible year number. So you have to zero in on what the year number must be first by other considerations. It's the same with radiocarbon. You can't just do radiocarbon and say, well, the radiocarbon are the most reliable way of doing it. That's far from true. It's one of the most unreliable ways, actually, of doing chronology is radiocarbon, which is shown by the radiocarbon at Dore. For example, the city of Dore showed that the late iron 1 to iron 2 transition, where the iron 2 age began at Dore, was 50 years or so later than at other cities, according to the radiocarbon at Dore. So you can't really rely on that. Here I've got radiocarbon from Tel Rehov that shows that there's the beginning of city 6, layer 6 at Tel Rehov. It falls right in the range of right here. The boundary is right there, 970 maybe, 973 if we look at the bulk of that peak. Let's bring it down lower. The boundary here for stratum 6, boundary is right there. See, that's that peak. In fact, that's the peak. It looks like that's the peak we looked at. Yeah. So that, and that's the change from, very certainly, they believe for Tel Rehov, this is the boundary between iron 1 and iron 2. So it looks like Shoshank in 973 in our chronology, right here, 973, very close to that, right, on this graph, 800, 900, 1000. Shoshank ushered in the Iron Age 2 chronological period of time. He's the one who ushered in Iron Age 2 and ended the Iron Age 1. And if that's true from Tel Rehov, which seemed to be the best stratified and the best results anywhere, and these are done at Groningen, which is also not necessarily the same as anywhere else, that's the problem with radiocarbon, but it agrees with our results, and it agrees with many other results. That's it at other cities, including Tel Dan as well. But there are many other cities with which the dating of the end of Iron Age 1 agrees with the dating at Tel Rehov. The question is, are we going to believe it? You know, because we have, remember, we had the invasion of the Sea Peoples coincided with the end of the Bronze Age, or the Bronze Age collapse, which was a period of drought also that had initiated it, apparently. The invasion of the Sea Peoples coincided with the end of the Bronze Age. So couldn't it be that Shishak, who invaded and destroyed so many cities, couldn't that also be the end of Iron 1, the beginning of Iron 2? Just like, so the end of a major phase in the pottery could coincide with a major invasion. That's it's one possibility, and it's a simple explanation for things, and it works in our chronology, not in other people's chronologies. So that's why we think we have the truth here. It's a major, I mean, that's not the only reason, because we've shown a mega million, kind of huge number of other reasons why we believe in our chronology. Let's go back to 194. I want to show you something. 194 and 193, whatever it is. 190, okay, good. The Ladder of Time at Tel Rehov, which is an article I've used before. In fact, that's not the article I just quoted from, I don't think. That was the next chapter, but this chapter, if you see these, on page 193 here, of this book by Levy and Higham, edited by them. This is written by Amahai Mazar, who, by the way, passed away. Unfortunately, I just learned that. He passed away last year, I understand. when I did the research to find out who he was. I often read these papers, I don't know who the people are. I don't have time, to research the details of every single paper, because I look at sometimes more than 10 papers in one day. But here, the dates measured at the Weizmann Institute during the late 1990s are consistently too low by 50 to 100 years when compared to those about radiocarbon, that is, from Arizona and Groningen. There's a lab in Tucson, Arizona, and there's a lab in Groningen. So these radiocarbon dates that are measured by the Weizmann Institute are 50 to 100 years lower. That shows you what you can see as the difference between different labs doing the measurements. So we can't use radiocarbon as our prime indicator for chronology, but it's very useful for becoming more confident and making our results more probable, definitely, and more certain as far as making discovering, first of all, right, whether or not our results agree with reality, right? Or making a case, let's say, making a good case, building a case for supporting the other information that we have, right? The information we got primarily was from the Bible. And only people who know the Bible understand how reliable the Bible is. So for a lot of people, they just oppose the Bible outright. They just choose, for whatever reason, to reject the Bible. And they've already rejected the Bible, so they don't have any qualms about ignoring the Bible chronology. But what we've done, what we did, was we used the Bible chronology, right? We believed it. And then we deduced what the the Bible doesn't give all the details, so we deduced what all the rest of it was to be consistent with the Bible, right? We did as much as we could. We're still doing more, I think, but we did as much as we could, and some of the archaeologists agree with us, definitely. It's called the extended conventional chronology here, by Amahai Mazar. And that extended conventional chronology puts the Iron 2A beginning in 980, roughly, which is in our chronology, 973, the invasion of Shishak, very close to the same time. It's only approximately 980, according to him, approximately 980. That fits very well with our date of 973. So his extended conventional chronology is what he calls it. We're calling it our own genealogy, but it's the same as far as that one date for the beginning of Iron 2A. It looks very similar, because we're saying that Iron 1 ended with the invasion of Shishak, and that's the beginning of Iron 2A. I mean, that's what we seem to be saying. I mean, if we find a better explanation, we'll have to go with that, but this is the best explanation. It simplifies everything. Iron 1 ends with the invasion of Shishak, just like the Bronze Age ended with the invasion of the Sea Peoples. It's such a great explanation for things. It simplifies our understanding. And no one else sees it the way we do. So that's why I found it necessary to make these publications, to explain my reasons for being excited about it too. I mean, I was so excited I had to make these publications, because they make a case for the Bible being correct. Now, if you can make a case for the Bible being correct, if the Bible's correct in one thing, in something as deep as chronology, in all the different archaeology involved, if the Bible's consistent with all that, Nelson Gluck certainly said that there was no archaeological discovery that had ever controverted a biblical reference. So there are archaeologists who devoutly believe the Bible, for sure. So if we can prove something, and I had to prove it for myself, everyone, I think, each one has to prove things for themselves, but when I proved the Bible for myself, I thought, I have to share this with others. If we prove the Bible's chronology, though, that doesn't automatically prove the rest, but it implies the rest of the Bible is worth looking into, right? To see whether what it says about everything else is correct. Jesus Christ and all the rest. But Moses, first of all, the beginning of the Bible. But even before that, the creation of the universe, Genesis, you know, the creation of Earth, all the life forms on Earth created by Jehovah, according to the Bible, according to their kinds, they were created. It was all done in a six-day period of time. Not all the universe, but from the beginning of when the events began to transpire in that six-day sequence, right? But it's all described in the Bible, and if that is all true, and that the part about Moses and everything is true with all the archaeology and the days of Joshua and Judges and all that we accounted for, we aligned precisely the year of the Judge Gideon with Pharaoh Merneptah of Egypt from an inscription by the Egyptian Pharaoh, perfectly aligned, and just happened totally out of the blue. We didn't expect that, or it just fell into place along with everything else lining up. So if all that fits through Judges and all that, then all the way down to Solomon, that fits because we can calculate back to the Exodus and we worked all this out. And then, so if all this is true, then doesn't it imply that we should look into the New Testament also about Jesus Christ and study about Jesus too and start to think that maybe that's true too, and as a starting point for being open-minded at least about the New Testament? So this is the reason for doing all this. It's not without reason, but I mean, people can study the New Testament right at the beginning and without any knowledge of anything else, and they can come to conclusions of it being true also. That's happened. But you can do it using study of prophecy in the Old Testament too, and seeing how prophecies came true. That's another way to build faith in the Bible. There are many ways to do it. It's August 5th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1939 hours Eastern Daylight Time in North America, Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you for listening and watching. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. But today we did some study from the book The Bible and Radiocarbon Dating by Thomas Levy and Thomas Higgleman, 2005. Also, we did Trojan War, the article, chapter 9, paragraph 2. Bye for now.